Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
In 2012, Karen and Barbara Fields published Racecraft, The Soul of Inequality in American Life. The puzzle the two authors and sisters raise is why a scientifically discredited idea of race persists. Racecraft is their term for the rational processes of reasoning that makes race appear to the mind and imagination as a vivid truth, in the same way that witchcraft once appeared real to very smart people. Believers in witchcraft had authoritative sources in the science and law of the day. Likewise, daily life produces an immense accumulation of supporting evidence for racecraft. The belief that humans are naturally divided into distinct groups identifiable by certain physical or other traits is a kind of magical thinking that people find impossible to let go of. For our ancestors and for us, it often seems impossible for so much evidence to accumulate around a conception which has no basis in fact. The Fields helped me resolve a problem that I had been wrestling with for a while. Oil matters more today than other metals and minerals in that the world pays some 10 times more for the good annually than it does for gold, iron, and copper, the next three most valuable raw material exports. But like race, popular and scholarly beliefs about oil as power also have no basis in fact. Yet evidence for the belief continues to accumulate in the rhetoric of U.S. officials, academics, and the press. And like racecraft, oilcraft has its insidious, all too real consequences.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Middle East Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Nancy Koh, your host for today, and that was Robert Vitalis riffing off of his latest book, Oilcraft, The Myths of Scarcity and Security That Haunt U.S. Energy Policy, and that's out with Stanford University Press this past July. Bob is also the author of America's Kingdom, Mythmaking on the Saudi Oil Frontier, and When Capitalists Collide, Business Conflict and the End of Empire in Egypt. He's also a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to the podcast, Bob.
Thanks. And it's great to be here. This is one of my favorite podcast series, actually.
That's great to hear. So one of the things I love reading about you, Bob, whether in your earlier work or here in Oilcraft, is the way that you don't just break down certain powerful myths as untrue, which they are. You also tell us a little bit about why they're so compelling in the first place and how they come to shape reality. So, you know, Bob is your way too honest friend, you know? So I'm pleased to warn the audience that in Oilcraft, there is no mercy to be had, neither on hawkish foreign policy experts, nor CNN pundits, nor even on their critics, the what Bob calls the tenured radicals whose glib critiques unwittingly reinforce the premises of right-wing grand strategists. But before we get into the nitty-gritty particulars of Oilcraft, I wanted to ask you, you know, as you point out in Oilcraft, people like Morris Edelman and Roger Stern have long been trying to demystify our myths about oil. What brought you to this book and why now?
You know, it's a great question. I don't know that I can solve that actually. I'll tell you, one of the inspirers of the book or who got me working on the topic is Victoria de Grazia in your department. She invited me to a conference where I started to lay out bits of this argument. Now, that goes back about I don't know, almost like 15 years ago now. I've been wrestling with our ideas about oil and geopolitics for some time. And it started to develop this like kind of revisionist account about some of the arguments that oil and grand strategists make that seem to me to be either not falsifiable or empirically invalidated. And I guess this book is the culmination of my working on these issues for some time and continuing to engage scholars who were also interested in challenging some of these deeply held beliefs, like Roger Stern, and then my old friend Ellis Goldberg, who passed away last September, Vicky, and others. So
that's fabulous. And can you tell us, for the audience, what exactly is oilcraft? Can you voice the myth for us and maybe tell us a little bit about where it began?
Well, what I argue in the book is oil is simply another commodity that is bought and sold on the world market. Okay, oilcraft are the processes of reasoning that make it appear otherwise. And that lead to many deeply held beliefs. For instance, one that Juan Gonzalez has repeated on Democracy Now, that Brian Black has written in his book about oil, that many, many people are write and argue and believe, which is that states have gone to war for oil numerous times in the past. One of the problems is you can't actually demonstrate that as true.
Right. And so what are some of these myths? I mean, I know that you point in particular to two surrounding security, ideas about security and ideas about scarcity, right? And I'm actually reminded of, Alan Greenspan's whole advocating the removal of Saddam Hussein, on the, premise that, the fear that, rival power, that because oil is this sort of supposedly scarce resource, rival powers are going to conspire to gain exclusive control over foreign supplies. Or that, countries like Iraq under Saddam, or for example, a less friendly Saudi monarchy will choose not to sell the oil. This is all the sort of, legwork that this sort of reasoning is doing so that someone like Alan Greenspan can say something like that, right? But can you flesh out a little bit more what's going on here? What exactly is this argument about, like, oil vis-a-vis pricing, for instance?
Great. So when I knew I was going to write this book, what I started with what I lay out as the kind of three axioms that help us to undermine the false beliefs about oilcraft. The first being that in a market full of buyers and sellers, everyone has access. So you need do nothing special in order to secure access to that commodity. Now, if you think about it, since the nationalization of the Western oil firms in the Middle East in the 1970s, the United States has expressed as a central part of its policy in the Middle East the need to guarantee access to oil, right? Every president from Jimmy Carter to President Obama have articulated that over and over again. So axiom number one says, actually, the United States need do nothing in order to secure access to oil. Now, that is such a deeply held belief that especially oil security experts, grand strategists and the like can't really deal with that argument. From their perspectives, oil is so valuable to the world economy and is so vulnerable to disruption and or such a target for rising or enemy states that one must act to protect the prize, to use Daniel Yergin's argument. The second axiom I said, and I basically stole this from a security expert at MIT, which is that, his name is Barry Posen. He wrote a book called Restraint, calling for a new foreign policy of offshore balancing. Basically, Barry's argument is the United States doesn't need to be in the Middle East. There is no strategic rationale, a verifiable strategic rationale for being in the Middle East, including protecting the al-Saud in power. If, and this is a big if why you're there is to secure the flow of oil, because there's no need to do that. And Barry argues that the kinds of military threats that either, you know, security experts or what I call some enchanted amateurs who imagine themselves as, you know, global energy supply experts or students of the realpolitik of American hegemony, are the threats that, or are the need, are the threats and or the reasons why the U.S. is there in the region? Barry Posen works through the logic and sort of says, no good. Either the threats are not real, or, and this is a key part, they're not amenable to solution by military means. Right? The United States is never going to be able to stop a revolution in Saudi Arabia, where that revolution to take place. Think about the other revolutions inside the region, the other upheavals. The United States has been unable to change or stave off, et cetera. So the belief that somehow U.S. presence in the Middle East is this force for stability and oil supply security, Barry says, is wrong. And then the third axiom. Yeah, go ahead.
I think it's interesting how those two myths kind of interplay with one another, of course, right? Because this notion that, like, this pretense that, oh, the United States can, you know, intervene in Saudi Arabia and that that would ostensibly, you know, prevent some kind of uprising. Underneath that is an anxiety that goes back to the first myth, which is that there's something special about the U.S.-Saudi relationship, right? And that there's something about the relationship between the U.S. and the al-Saud monarchy that ensures oil supply, right, and oil export from there, right, and but that, as you say, debunking the first myth, that's actually not true.
Everything we believe about the U.S.-Saudi so-called special relationship is fiction. And what I discovered in the book, one of the discoveries in the book, was how recent the latest piece of fiction or the latest myth is, right? And that's the idea that the United States struck a bargain with the al-Saud back in 1945 on board the USS Quincy that is basically the core of that bargain is oil for security. Now, I'm sure you've heard that phrase. You might have used it in a lecture. You might have heard people using it in lectures. You hear it on TV. It's repeated all the time now. Well, what I discovered was the first time anyone ever argued that fact, that idea that some bargain was struck at on the Quincy back in 1945 was in 2001. Literally months after 9/11. And what I'm so struck by is, right, we have 60 years of careful history writing about the United States in the Middle East, about the U.S.-Saudi relationship, and no book from the first one that was ever written was written in 1949, rather, by a guy named Sanger. No book through Nadav Safran's studies of Saudi security policy, Greg Goss writing about international relations in the Middle East and so forth. No book ever said something about an oil for security deal negotiated back in 1945. In all those decades, it is only since 9/11, and it took a while for the myth to take to arise or gain strength, and now it's just believed without question.
So to recap, we've discussed the myth that oil access is threatened, and the second myth, which is that it must thus be secured via military might, to which you respond in the first that oil is threatened no more than any other natural resource is, and that putative threats to oil price and supply that ostensibly motivate U.S. force in the Middle East, for instance, are not compelling or else you know, cannot be dealt with efficiently by military power anyway. What's the third myth that we're trying to get at?
Yes. So the third axiom comes from a third critic of our beliefs about oil, and that's Roger Stern. And what Roger did, you know, he's been working on a huge book on this topic for a long time now. But what Roger did, and I'd never seen anyone do before, is map oil prices, right, onto a graph that along with the prices of all other raw materials and commodities. And what we find is those prices co-vary. Right? They go up and down together. And this is true for the course of the 20th century and into the 21st century. And I said, wow, I've never seen a map like that. Because, of course, if you think about it today, on any random day, we will learn something about oil prices. Right. OPEC plus might the market might be too soft for OPEC plus, meaning OPEC plus Russia, to increase production. And whatever action OPEC is taking is believed to have some kind of remarkable effect on the price of oil. And at the same time, unless you study the business pages, unless you're an investor or reading the back pages of the Wall Street Journal, you don't know what the prices of copper are doing or what the prices of gold are doing or what the prices of cotton are doing. And what they're mostly doing is rising and falling in tandem. So what that means is that the main determinant of oil prices is not the actions of a so-called cartel, which is no longer a cartel and was only a cartel for a short period of time. It's not the action of cartels or actors or Saudi Arabia as an alleged swing producer. It's macroeconomic supply and demand questions. The best we could say is that in distinct moments, right? And there's very few of them, actually, though we think that somehow oil producers have this power to control the price of oil or bring it up and down and so forth. The best we could say that is that in discrete moments and infrequently, not frequently, the best that might happen is that troughs in prices, how far they fall, or rises in prices, how high they rise, right, can be affected on the margins by those producers. But it's rare that that happens, okay? But instead, we have this vision of, you know, a constant manipulation of oil prices by OPEC or Saudi Arabia, the Russians, and so forth. And typically then, you get kinds of political causes for those manipulations, especially on the part of, radical critics on the left.
So let's hang back a little bit. You point to two sort of foundational moments or phases of oil craft making, right? The first being in the sort of 1920s and the second being in the 1970s. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on in the 1920s that's sort of setting the stage for everything that you're talking about now?
Sure. I was an undergrad. We have to digress. I was an undergraduate in the 1970s, started a college in the midst of the 1973 so-called crisis with the gasoline lines in the United States. And I was a commuter to college. So I was on those gas lines myself. But that's also the moment when I started toward the end of my college career studying American foreign policy for the first time. And at that moment, critics of American foreign policy had a powerful argument that they made, which was that the United States was involved around the world, in the third world, in Southeast Asia and so forth, primarily to control raw materials. It's the need to control them or extract them or have access to them or preserve their connection to them is what drove all of American foreign policy, or drove imperialism, or drove the Vietnam War, et cetera. It's kind of this raw materials argument was quite powerful. Well, I went back and found where those arguments first started to be made systematically, and that was in the 1920s. So it was a mainstay of a common sense knowledge and studies of capitalism and studies of the first studies of international economics or geopolitics to argue that the great powers were involved in attempts to control, secure, gain access to, preserve, have monopoly holds over raw materials of all sorts. Now, the reason I am telling you this is you don't hear that argument anymore. You know, I'm sure that if you took a course on the, well, you also do Asian American stuff, but if you did a course on South Asian history or American foreign policy in South Asia, no one is going to make an argument that the war in Vietnam was for control of raw materials, right? This deep belief that was held until about, I think, you know, the late 70s and 80s. And what I argue is a funny thing happened is that all the beliefs of what we at the time called either new Marxist or the new left or neo-Marxist or revisionist diplomatic historians about raw materials have disappeared. And instead, we've kind of reconfigured or reorganized that story to tell it as one about the drive to preserve, control, gain access to, monopolize one commodity only, and that's oil. So I was really struck by how, you know, there's this like shift or like in the gestalt from commodities of all sorts to the demand for one commodity. And I, you know, basically concluded that it's really what explains that is the what I call the national trauma of 1973.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Wow. So I'm really struck by that the role of 1920s in your book. And if you actually go into the footnotes of Bob's book, he goes into the newspaper article titles from the 1920s, which are actually quite amazing. So you have one from, I think, 1923 or something from the Christian Science Monitor about Caucasian solidarities, you know, but you also have stuff from like the New York Times sort of trotting out the very discourse that the so-called Columbia School that Bob talks about, you know, were critiquing, but the script kind of going that the Great War, World War One, and the concomitant world instability, you know, was caused by the unequal world distribution of a vast array of raw materials. So, you know, would a renewed struggle for colonies or for raw materials lead to another war between white people, or would a, you know, heretofore unknown phenomenon, the sort of ominous rising racial consciousness of the East, of, you know, quote unquote Mohammedans or Asiatics, right? You know, threaten the West by sort of imitating their signature imperialist methods. You know, and in oilcraft, you know, as you say in your book, you know, this is this moment when a lot of this sort of myth making about oilcraft, but also critiques of it, comes into being. But I was wondering if you could chat a little bit about your earlier work with regard to this before we go into the 70s, because as you say in America's Kingdom, your earlier book about Aramco, sort of biography of Aramco, the 1920s are also, you know, when Americans export Jim Crow methods of dividing labor by race to Saudi Arabia, amongst other imperial outposts, of course. And, you know, we began this episode with an analogy between oilcraft and racecraft, but there seems to be an even more on-the-ground connection here, you know, vis-a-vis American foreign policy and racism. I mean, Jim Crow and Aramco began just as we became sort of colorblind in the U.S. And the war to end the racial wage system would be reenacted in Saudi Arabia as opposed to just on American shores. So how can we think of these two stories together? I mean, that of the one that you tell in Oilcraft in the 1920s and thereafter, and that of America's Kingdom.
It's a great question, and I need to fill in a gap in the bibliography, okay, which will help you to understand something about America's Kingdom, which you've read, and the connection you want me to make here, and there is a connection, which is, you know, I started working on Saudi Arabia, put that project, what would eventually become America's Kingdom in 2005, put that project down, and instead started to work on a different book, which was a revisionist history of the discipline of international relations in the United States, and there were two elements to that revisionism. Element number one was that the birth of that discipline was really what drove the discipline was were racism. Right, the discipline thought in racist terms about world order, and it studied imperialism. So the big problem for IR, why international relations in the United States comes into existence in the 1920s, is the fear of the threats to the West arising from either imperial rivalries over the territorial possessions around the world with their raw materials and so forth, and worse, and this is what you were hinting at in Oilcraft in the reference you gave, and worse, that the benighted races of the East were starting to revolt against us. Okay, so no one studying international relations in the United States up until a few years ago said the discipline was really concerned about sustaining white world supremacy over the threatened revolt of the West. Okay, so I was working on that book, but put it down to return to write America's Kingdom. Doesn't matter why that was. But that explains to you why in America's Kingdom, you find references to W.E.B. Du Bois, because I had really started studying Afro-America at that point and did that. And doing that work helped me to understand the nature of Jim Crow and the building of the Jim Crow system in Saudi Arabia. So when I finished America's Kingdom, I came out with the revisionist history of international relations, white world order, black power politics, the birth of American international relations. Now, in the last chapter of that book, I lay out, I didn't say this to people, but I lay out in a few paragraphs what will be the next two books I work on. Oilcraft was one of them. So that's a kind of long-winded way of telling you the following, that it seems to me that we can trace at least one strand, what one strand of Oilcraft is today, that is these factitious beliefs about oil and why it's necessary to secure it against threats. Well, one of those strands goes back to the 1920s, and it's basically racist, to put it crudely, meaning this. Back in the 1920s, folks were convinced either that the West that needed it, well, here's how it went. The West needs these raw materials of all sorts, not just oil. These raw materials happen to be located far from the West, and in fact tended to be located in what they call the tropics, where the pseudoscience of race said back then, Westerners, white people, can't exist, right? So they had to come up with special forms of colonialism to be able to guarantee the extraction of these resources that the West needed for their survival. And in fact, you start to get these arguments made that the resources of the colonized areas of the world do not belong to the folks who live, there, or, you know, are sitting by accident on top of the ground where these things exist, but they belong, they're the common heritage of mankind. They belong to the West, they belong to the peoples who can utilize them and need them, right? So what gets spun out of those kinds of ideas is this idea that Arabs, say, okay, or Venezuelans or Chinese will not be able to produce these resources without the West, because they're incapable of getting them to market, and or they're so irrational that they would not let them come get to market if they happen to gain control of them. And so you can read about most of the 20th century, from, let's say, 1920s through the period of decolonization, right? As a, you know, one of the arguments is about what will happen to the West if decolonization takes place, because in one way or another, the irrational or incapable Easterners, if you want, are not going to allow us to have the resources that we need. Well, that argument, it seems to me, beliefs of this type, of the, you know, kind of irrationality or incapacities of non-Western peoples or Arab peoples, holds to this day. And so one example of that is the idea that if Arabs nationalized their oil, it would doom the West, because the Arabs would not be able to get the oil to market, right?
And you think about Mossadegh in Iran, for example.
Exactly. Well, Mossadegh, it's perfect, because Mossadegh is a classic example of, right, think about how he was described traditionally in the press of the West, right? Once he started to make noises about nationalization, he's irrational, he's a madman, et cetera, right? Well, those are the adjectives used for virtually every third world nationalist leader from Mossadegh on. You know, in before too, but definitely from Mossadegh on. So the Arabs will not be able to do this. Why folks were calling for in after 1973 for the U.S. to consider occupying the oil fields, because they will not be able to deliver the goods to market. Well, look what happens, right? Oil is now nationalized everywhere. It is not Western oil firms that are producing it. It's state-owned oil companies. It's indigenous knowledge, right? In the sense that, you know, Saudis are now perfectly capable of running their oil enterprises, Iraqis are, and so forth. And yet we have, none of the predictions came to pass, right? None of these, what were ultimately kind of racist projections onto the madmen of the third world or the deficient minds of third world peoples, as we used to say, none of those predictions about the crisis that would ensue had ever come to pass. But we still see the arguments made. So Saddam can't be trusted to get the oil to market, or he's going to take it all over and he's going to undermine the Western economy. So why we have to take him out? These kinds of arguments are still with us in a way, and they go way back.
I think what's even crazier about all of this is that, like, when these arguments are starting to come to the fore in the 1920s, that the U.S. was like the largest oil producing country in the world at the time, right? And yet people still sort of managed to get convinced that it was in our best interest to then, you know, confront the British in far flung places, right? That, you know, America is like running out of oil. And it's interesting that this is also like a constitutive part or premise of the sort of aggressive altruism, to use Parker Boone's term, the sort of aggressive altruism that you're talking about.
Here I'm taking the analysis from Roger Stern. But what Roger says is that, you know, there have been, you know, you could graph oil price increases and decreases, or the instability, right, in the oil markets. And it's in those moments when oil prices are rising that the fear is generated or, you know, produced that the world is running out of oil or the U.S. is running out of oil. So one must take extraordinary steps to secure what is left. Now, the last time we heard that argument, right, powerfully, was in 2002, 2003, 2004, with the invasion of Iraq by the United States. Think about how, well, you weren't there, but I can tell you, because I was doing anti-war demonstrations at the time and listening to some of my colleagues, you know, arguing things like, really what Iraq war is about is that the United States is locked in a war with China for control of the remaining dwindling resources, oil resources of the world, and the only thing that could be if some people thought that was a good thing, right? Because they're nationalists and they think the United States must do this, or if you were a critic of U.S. The U.S. policy at that time, you argued the only way to avoid these kinds of conflicts in the future, because they're definitely going to be increasing, we're going to have more oil wars and all other kinds of wars for resources. The only way to stop that is by ending the fossil fuel regime or going green, right, et cetera. And, you know, I want us to, like, it's now almost 20 years from that time, and you notice that the world has not run out of oil. The United States and China are not locked in a war for what was left. The oil that Chinese state-owned oil companies have secured in various places in Africa, et cetera, are not for China, but are basically sold on the world market. And as I show in my book, most of the oil that Chinese state-owned oil companies produce globally go to non-Chinese buyers, go to buyers outside of China. So so this whole notion that the world was going to run out of oil and we are locked in conflict for what's left looks kind of crazy right now from the vantage point of 2020.
Right, the time kind of speaks for itself, doesn't it? I want to take us back, to 1973, to what Timothy Mitchell, also of Columbia, called the crisis that never actually happened. And before you say anything, I do want to clarify for the audience a detail that's rather important and yet often forgotten. So that OPEC and OAPEC are different. We've got OPEC, the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, right, founded in 1960 in Baghdad. Then we have OAPEC, the Organization of Arab Petroleum Exporting Countries. Take us away, Bob.
Well, if you go online and I did this, right, in preparation for writing one of the essays. If you go online and type OPEC embargo, you will get more hits than you can possibly deal with from amateurs to learned professors at the Belfer Center at Harvard, all of who analyze what the so-called OPEC embargo did to the West or to the United States or to Europe or to those people who hate Israel. You get all these kind of crazy things out there. But basically, the argument is OPEC embargoed the West in 1973. Well, it absolutely did not do that. OPEC, you know, this Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, understood and made clear that boycotts could not work. And they could not work for the reasons that Maury Adelman laid out quite clearly in 1973. You can't boycott one country, right? So Saudi Arabia called for, you know, at that time, Saudi Arabia called for a boycott of the United States because of its support for Israel, as you know. And the boycott was extended to Rhodesia, South Africa, and the Netherlands, basically. Sorry, Portugal, South Africa, and the Netherlands for a variety of reasons. And Maury Adelman tried to tell the Nixon administration, you shouldn't worry about this because no country can boycott, no oil producer can boycott one country without boycotting all countries. If you're not cutting off production to the world, well, then that boycotted country is just going to get oil from one of the other oil producers. And that is exactly what happened. So for, as you as any Middle Eastern history textbook will tell you, that for a few short months in late 1973 and early 1974, Arab oil producers, with Iraq being a notable exception, called for a boycott of the United States, and they called that the boycott was called ostensibly until the Palestinians get their legitimate rights and Israel withdraws from the territories. And as I note in the book, the boycott is called off quietly 6 months later with none of those objectives met. And at the same time, Saudi Arabia quietly was delivering oil all that time to the single largest oil consumer in the United States, which was the U.S. military. So even as it's ostensibly boycotting American oil in response to the 73 war, it's quietly supplying the U.S. military with oil. So no, OPEC never boycotted anyone. The production cutbacks that took place did not have the effects that folks imagined it to have. And maybe the most important one is that though it's still miswritten today or misbelieved today, OPEC did not quadruple the price of oil by fiat, as folks imagine. None of that happened.
Right, right. So I was wondering then if you could talk about the sort of what you call the all too real effects of oil craft in general, but particularly of the sort of OPEC 1973 myth, in particular about since especially 1979, you know, the deployment of U.S. military force for, you know, guaranteeing access to oil resources and sort of approach that, you know, was inherited, you know, from Carter to Reagan to H.W. Bush. And I think in particular of the 82 intervention in the Lebanese Civil War.
So, again, well, here, let me stop and say something that I should have emphasized more in the book, but I didn't. And though Andrew Bacevich recognized it early on in one of his books, there's a funny thing about U.S. policy after 1973. So you do have an oil crisis, the so-called oil crisis and gas lines and so forth. And my book goes into what were really the causes of those gas lines, et cetera. It wasn't an embargo or production cutbacks. But here's the funny thing. If you were to go, you know, the Pentagon has to write basically strategy documents, right, for itself every year, as the national defense policy of the United States. So right. Despite 1973 and what we remember of it, 74, 75, 76, 77, there is virtually no talk about the need to use military force to secure oil supplies for the United States. So at the worst time of the crisis, it was never envisioned that one needed the military to do this. And what Andrew Bacevich is surprised, you know, shocked by or remarks upon or underlines, which is then all of a sudden with the fall of the Shah and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, lo and behold, the argument goes, the military has to be there. Otherwise, we might be cut out of, you know, oil, or we need military force projection to secure the free flow of oil. And, you know, as you know, the Carter Doctrine says we're in the regions of vital national security interest, and it's right. In our interest to protect, to stop any outside power from coming in to take over the oil, with this fantasy concocted that the Soviets were actually seeking to control the oil supplies of the Persian Gulf. And I try to spend some time in the book explaining why none of that made sense. But so for six key years, right, after the crisis, no one ever think you needed you needed a military solution to an ostensible supply problem, which really wasn't the problem. And then it becomes a problem in the 70s, and it goes up and down as a problem in those next decades. But the military is still there, and somehow it's imagined that military is doing something beneficial. Depends, again, what lens you're wearing. For some nationalists in the United States, it's imagined the military is there to get the oil because the U.S. needs that oil. an argument that I kind of try to undermine in the book. For others, like the more globally visionary type folks, they see the U.S. military in place to make sure that the oil gets to their allies who really need it. So it's like this a welfare good that the U.S. is supplying to its Western allies. Lefties see these same policies and argue quite the opposite. This is actually the way the United States controls its capitalist allies in the West and Japan. By being in the Persian Gulf, we are ready at any time, I don't know, if they do something we don't like, to block their oil supply. I have absolutely no idea how this would work and why we think this would happen. But that is what folks believe and continue to write it today and so forth. So they're kind of like fantasy upon fantasy upon fantasy that has become embedded. And somehow in all of this, Saudi Arabia is imagined as the key, right? The key to U.S., you know, security and so forth. And that somehow Saudi Arabia is imagined, right? What is the U.S.-Saudi special relationship supposed to be doing? Somehow the Saudi Arabians do something for the United States that they otherwise would not do. And I've yet to figure out what that is. Because there's no evidence that, for instance, you know, Saudi Arabia makes the price of oil lower than it otherwise would be, or if it were a different country, they'd be able to have, you know, jack up the price and somehow that they're doing that for us, or that they're supplying more oil to the United States than anywhere else. It's just always completely unclear to me what the oil side of this oil for security bargain is, save, I mean, what I conclude is, you know, some people think it's just that the Saudis sell oil. And that's the favor they're doing. But of course, that's no favor to the United States or to any other oil consuming country in the world. That's the strategy they must deploy in order to continue to exist.
Right. That is also, you know, just how markets work. So it's interesting, you know, this common denominator that you're pointing out amongst otherwise antagonistic, you know, perspectives, the right wing grand strategists, the sort of left wing critics. But you know, again, as you say, there's sort of these nested fantasies that, you know, begin in the 20s. How did we forget the critique of the Columbia School? I mean, so between the 20s and the 70s, you kind of point to the 70s as a sort of traumatic moment, or at least the period from 73 until until the Soviet invasion and the Iranian Islamic Revolution in 79. But it seems like there's a kind of amnesia here. How did we forget that earlier era of critique of precisely what we're talking about here?
Well, so, I mean, there were these sets of professors. They were incredibly smart folks. They were progressives to a person in the 1920s, Edward Mead Earle, who people still read today, but they read him in a different context. He's imagined now as someone who helped to start the field of grand strategy studies or U.S. security studies in the United States. And that was in the 1940s doing World War II. So he's going to show up in Stephen Wertheim's new book that's just out today about the U.S. decision during the war, right? Or how the U.S. comes to the decision that it's going to police the world at the end of World War II, something that was not obvious to American policymakers at the beginning of World War II. So Wertheim is a Columbia PhD, but also, you know, the second in command at the Quincy Institute. So people like Edward Mead Earle, Parker Moon, Leland Jenks were these progressive era critics who said the arguments of imperial powers that they needed to secure these resources of all sorts, otherwise they would be destroyed. They worked through the arguments and looked at the data and sort of said, you know, none of this makes any sense. And in fact, it's illusory. And because they were progressives, right, they believed to a person that what was really going on was that business interests were dictating or were really the source of these strategic beliefs in the 1920s of the need, for instance, to, that was the time when Britain is fighting for a oil concession in what will become Iraq, right? And of course, great powers or policymakers always argued these things in terms of securing the national interest, making sure that these supplies are available to their citizens or subjects and so forth. And the Columbia School critics sort of said, well, none of this makes any sense. And really what it is the special pleading of these firms for backing by the state. And firms getting backing by the state can't say, hey, you need to do this simply because it'll make us richer, the investors richer. You need a national security argument for them. So they kind of started to debunk, I would put, the national security arguments about the 1920s and the need for colonies. If the idea was that the colonies were there to secure the resources that English men and women needed, or French men and women needed, because they basically determined that the colonies were actually supplying minuscule amounts of the strategic resources that they needed of all sorts. So they were debunking these ideas and challenging them at the time. And all of them were forgotten in the next round of the rise of during the Cold War in the 1940s and 50s, especially in the 1950s and then in the 1960s, as the new left starts to develop their critique of imperialism and post-World War II American foreign policy, the left comes to accept as true, right, those arguments that the Columbia professors were saying are patently not true, and so they must be there as rationalizations for other things.
I think what's interesting here is that, that sort of, I mean, as you say that, even within their own time, the Columbia School, in a sense, makes very little headway, right? I mean, in face of these sort of apocalyptic accounts of scarcity, dependency, and so on and so forth, the U.S. and other sort of imperial powers actually double down on their colonies, double down on China and Persia as they call them their semi-colonies. And I guess what's interesting is that, then after the sort of Cold War era, what you're talking about, the sort of new left, within academia, we then have the sort of Huntington-Fukuyama line, right? And it just strikes me that this book is as much about academia as it is, in a sense, about foreign policy in that sense.
I would say it's fundamentally about academia, because I ran into this problem, right? You haven't asked me this question yet, but usually what people ask me when we're talking about this book for a while is, okay, so what was the Iraq War really about if it wasn't for oil? And I don't say that it was or wasn't for oil because I say I can't get into the hearts and minds. I can't read the minds of George Bush. But what I discovered was, or what I concluded was, you can take academics at their word. Okay, so rather than focusing on the utterances of policymakers, written down on the page claims of academics, I assume, are what they truly believe. And so I tend to spend much more time analyzing those folks, right? Whether it's Sam Huntington or Fukuyama, and who knew, I didn't certainly, that what Fukuyama's first serious work was a defense of the need to protect oil supplies, to protect the Persian Gulf from the obvious Soviet threat, since the Soviets were coming. This is really his first work, and so forth. So I look at those folks like Fukuyama and Huntington. Huntington probably did more than anyone else I don't actually believe scholars have influence on policy. I think that scholars are the useful ventriloquists. Policymakers use them like to justify positions they're already going to take anyway. So Huntington served as a useful ventriloquist for Brzezinski, his friend, etc.
Right.
But nonetheless, Samuel Huntington probably did more to articulate the logic of a U.S. military presence in the Gulf against the Soviets, an argument that, of course, was argued by an argument that everyone assumed at the time. You had to be, you sounded crazy if you, someone like Fred Halliday is one of the few people who criticized these ideas at the time, said, you know, if you think the Soviets are coming into the Persian Gulf to access oil, you don't understand geopolitics, nor do you understand oil markets, right? He was a critic all the way, but he was like a kind of a lone voice at that time. But these beliefs are so deeply ingrained that, you know, you could go to foreign policy now, foreign affairs, say, and I remember Kenneth Pollack and Stephen Cook, the Council on Foreign Relations expert, just wrote an article, I think about 6 months ago, that explained the tremendously successful U.S. foreign policy of militarizing the Gulf because, after all, they secured the oil supply for the United States and kept it out of the hands of the Soviets. So this was like the great triumph of the Cold War. And, they, you know, it just sounds completely kooky to me, because there's no evidence of any of that. It's just, you know, it's like witchcraft, right? You know, witches don't exist, but people constantly see them. So here are these guys just conjuring up this evidence without any, you know, proof, basically. They're just the common wisdom. And as Maury Adelman, the economist, said, you know, common sense knows many things that are not true.
Right. I mean, in a way, it seems like this whole story to me, from the perspective of the United States, is a, and you sort of say, in a way, this is a book about, you said about America's kingdom, actually, that it was above all a book about America more than it was about Saudi Arabia. And I think, obviously, all the more so true for oilcraft. I think what's really about is a sort of fundamental discomfort with, and thus, you know, desperate way to figure out ways around the ultimate interdependency of a global capitalist market, right? So I was reminded especially of what you were saying about Thomas Friedman's, I'm sure the audience knows him, his sort of rhetoric about America being addicted to oil and the sort of alternative being a kind of living green as a sort of solution to dependency on foreign oil. But of course, like, doesn't that also reproduce exactly all of the myths that you're talking about, right? That there is no way to insulate the United States from, you know, for example, the effects of price spikes.
Absolutely right. So now you get these, right? You know, there is actually, you'll see analysts and commentators making moves towards some of the arguments I'm making in this book, but for the wrong reasons, right? So, or here, let me be more frank about it, or clear, or more straightforward about it. Bernie Sanders' main foreign policy advisor, a guy named Doss, okay, said something like this recently. It's Matt Doss, Matthew Doss, and I met him not too long ago. Matt Doss said, look, President Roosevelt and Ibn Saud cut a deal in 1945 to secure oil for to guarantee Saudi oil or Middle East oil for U.S. security. That deal was cut. It was really important because then we needed that oil. We don't need that oil anymore, so we can pull out of the Gulf now. So that's how Bernie's main foreign policy advisor was justifying a kind of retreat from the Gulf. Like, you know, and I don't know if he truly believes this. I wrote to him and said, do you truly believe this? But, right, that's the way I think some analysts or some policymakers and some advisors imagine in 2020, we can have a different policy because, you know, we're now producing our own oil through unconventional shale and so forth. And we no longer need the Persian Gulf. And you hear this argument over and over again, right? And that's just kooky. It's a kooky argument because, as you just suggested, right, it is one world oil market. And when oil prices go up, for whatever reason, refinery fires in Saudi Arabia, or how about this, right? Sanctions on Iran, Venezuela, historically on Iraq, right? And they're not trying to guarantee access to oil, but actually, you know, kind of stopping oil production from happening. When prices go up or when prices go down, the oil, as they are right now, right? Because of you know, because of COVID, basically, and the lack of demand. The U.S. oil market is affected in precisely the same way as the Saudi oil market is affected. The prices are the same. So there is no insulating the United States, save if you were to erect like a massive new protectionist regime. And no one's, you know, no one's arguing for that, or at least they're not yet.
So let's get down to, you know, the sort of present into the future, right? So you've demystified, I think, you know, your book seems to be doing a couple, like two different things, right? Like on the one hand, you're demystifying oil as a raw material, just like any other that functions on the global market, which both means, you know, on the one hand, that we as, you know, in the United States cannot insulate ourselves from that market by becoming more somehow independent, less dependent on Saudi oil, but also, and this is a critique of the sort of imperialist instinct that we were spending on earlier, that a post-Saudi Arabia can be counted on to sell its oil on the world market anyway, right? Like this has happened before. Iran did so after 79. Iraq, you know, Saddam no less, did so after the nationalization of foreign concessions. So you've done that demystifying work. And I guess it leaves me with this other question, because your book seems to be doing this other thing as well, which is trying to suggest a more wary, less mystified way forward. And I wanted to ask you straight on, like what that was. I know that you made brief reference in the book to, I think Steven Pinker's whole notion of going nuclear as an alternative, but what is the way forward for you?
Well, I am not a climate or energy expert, right? And I don't have a blueprint for a Green New Deal or any other alternative. That's not what the book is about. So for me, what's going for the what is important in going forward is, you know, I guess I think about it this way. So say you're an activist, okay? I've got a better example for you. So we tried to foment a coup in Venezuela recently. Well, the left argued it's obvious why we're doing that. Because we're interested in the raw material. We're interested in oil. And I, you know, this is like the goofiest thing I had ever heard, because of course, Venezuela is a reliable supplier of oil to the United States. Refineries in the United States were owned by Venezuelans, just as refineries are owned, by the way, in the United States are owned by Saudi Arabia. So when people predicted, for instance, that now that we're fracking, we won't be getting Saudi oil imports anymore. That was another piece of, it was just goofy nonsense, because Saudi refineries exist in the United States to as reliable markets for Saudi crude. So, you know, Saudi owned oil refineries are buying Saudi owned crude. Oil did not, you know, oil imports from Saudi Arabia did not end as fracking increased, etc. So my idea is, I wish folks who read this book, the next time you hear an argument like this, you are able to turn around and sort of say, you know, if the state is actually doing that, that would be a really stupid thing for it to do, because it doesn't need to do it. And or maybe you need yourself to rethink the extent to which you're holding on to this belief that underlying U.S. foreign policy has to be, right, these very crude material explanations. It's resources here. You know, right now it's in Ecuador, there, people believe there's going to be like a lithium war, et cetera, right? And it makes no sense, right?
It is an interesting kind of fetishization of the supposedly material and concrete. But I think what's fascinating here is the way in which, you know, efforts at sort of economic isolationism and then also of imperialism are sort of two sides of the same coin. Thank you so much for your time, Bob. I actually wanted to ask, so you mentioned By way of closing, you mentioned earlier that Oilcraft was one of two subsequent projects that you had pointed to in one of your earlier books. Can you tell us what the other one is or what you're working on in the future?
Well, if emphasis on the future, because have you noticed? So Oilcraft's the first book I've ever written that is not based in archival research, because I love working in archives more than life itself. It's given me such incredible pleasure. And of course, we're not going to any archives these days. Two or three years ago, I did some archival work, and my next project is, assuming I'm alive long enough, is a study of the rise of the militant right in American national security studies in the 1950s and 1960s.
Fabulous. And we're all going to be anxiously awaiting that. Final question. I noticed that you mentioned Taylor Swift in your acknowledgments. Favorite Taylor Swift album, Bob?
1989. Though I love them all.
You and me both. All right. Thanks so much, Bob, for chatting with us during these crazy, crazy times.
Take care, Nancy.
Thanks.